VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast. Zach.
The familiar safe territory of Monday.
Yeah, everyone loves a Monday. What have you been drinking, man?
So I think the highlight for me this past weekend, I was in the car a lot, which wasn't ideal, but I did drive out to Eastern Washington to go to a wine release party for a friend of mine's winery.
That's fun.
Yeah, Upside Down Wine.
Right side up wine or upside down?
Upside down. I did not end up upside down, although I could have gotten close by the end of the night. Anyhow, they do this yearly release of this special project they do called The Devil is a Liar, which is this Grenache-based wine from a very kind of special vineyard here in Washington called Weather Eye that Seth, the winemaker, ages in bear in these large fooder for like at least 3 years before releasing. So this was the 2020 vintage release party, which is pretty cool. Went out there for that, tried some of that, tried a lot of other wines, and that was really fun. I think the other thing highlight for me was actually got the chance the day before that to go out to dinner with Caitlin to a friend's restaurant, Sorrel, which I think I've talked about on the pod before. My friend Aaron owns it, and he only serves Washington wine there. It's been a big Washington wine weekend for me. What can I say? And it was very fun.
It's where you live.
So surprising for you, actually. You never drink Washington wine ever.
Yeah. Never. It never comes up. And I brought a couple of bottles with us, and we ended up sharing some of it with the couple sitting next to us at the sort of like chef's table, which was very fun because they had just moved to the state. So I got to kind of do a little bit of evangelizing. Again, shocking behavior for me, I'm sure. So yeah, cool. lots of good wine for me. Joanna,
nice.
What about you?
Yeah, I had a bottle of, well, I didn't drink the bottle myself.
Why?
Well, I wanted to, truly. No, Evan and I had a bottle of the Cobal Sauvignon Blanc, which is the Slovenian Sauvignon Blanc. Yeah. And that was on our recent Sauvignon Blanc list. Yeah, it's a good producer. That was really good. And then I felt inspired to get a gimlet this weekend after our gin and tonic conversation. It was fine. It was like a mediocre gimlet.
You know how it's just like,
no, it's just not worth saying. But you know, like gimlet, like I feel walks a very fine line. Like it has to be perfect or else it's totally out of balance. Like it's either too acidic or it's too sweet.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I think that's probably, it's like, again, it's balanced just like with a daiquiri or with a margarita. Like it's playing with that citrus, booze,
simple,
and sometimes it just like depending on who makes it. I think that's why they always have said, right, a daiquiri is
the best measure of a bartender's skill. Yeah.
Can they create balance?
Yeah.
And I think a really interesting thing about those three cocktails is that I think they each find a very different balance point. Like you would not want to just swap one spirit out for the other and say like my gimlet recipe is my daiquiri recipe is my margarita recipe.
Right, right.
Like you really need to treat them like individual drinks, but with, as you said, the same kind of base ingredients and a similar kind of idea behind them, even if, like I said, you think you find a different balancing point for each.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. What about you, Adam?
I drank a great bottle of wine from Forlorn Hope last weekend.
Okay.
But I also have a complaint, which I know you guys can't wait for.
Yes.
Wait, tell us about the wine. Where is that? I don't know. Where is Forlorn Hope?
Forlorn Hope is from the Sierra Foothills in California. And I've talked about another one of their wines that they're Queen of the Sierra.
Uh-huh.
This was one of their whites. And I drank it for a few reasons. One, I know the producer, but two, it was a date night and it was the most affordable bottle on a list. It was $60 when every other bottle was 100 plus on this list of this sort of like wine bar. I'm not going to say the name of the place, but it was like a wine bar restaurant in the Fort Greene neighborhood. And, you know, I think some of the people who own it come from other wine bars around the city. They're trying to do like, but again, they're not really doing the wine bar thing. They're doing like the like really chefy, but also big wine program thing. But the list was very expensive. That's one complaint. Second complaint was, this is going to make me sound like a fucking old man. It's like, I'm such a loser. But I really hate the wine lists where the type is so fucking small, and it's because it was one list
page.
Back one page back in front, but a fuck ton of bottles, and the type is so small, and then the price is so far on the other side of the page that you actually can't with your eyes line up which price is with which bottle. It's so frustrating. And so, and like, Naomi couldn't figure it out too. So then we like literally had to pull another menu to
as
like
a ruler.
Yes. Like, wait, is this the price? Why did you also
have your flashlight on your phone on?
No, it was bright enough. Okay, calm the fuck down. I'm not, not my dad yet. But like,
was the restaurant too loud for you?
No, it was fine with the volume level. Okay, Zach. But I really don't like when places do that. Like, just
do you think it's intentional?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it's not. It's conserving paper. I don't know. Get a second page. It's so annoying. And then my other pet peeve is, again, we continue talking about with wine, which is how is it that fucking hard to have affordable bottles on your list? The list was so expensive. And we people are going to be we each had a cocktail.
Mm-hmm. How much were the cocktails?
20.
Okay.
Which, don't even get me started on the cocktail.
You've gotten me started.
It tasted like cough syrup.
Oh,
like,
yikes.
It was clarified. Again, the clarifying's getting cool again. And so so Naomi was like, oh, you should try this one. I'll try mine. So mine was clarified. It had like a coconut wash to it with rum. Literally tasted like cough syrup.
I'm not a clarified cocktail person.
It was horrible. Mm-hmm. And I just was not going to send it back, but I did not like it. So I immediately ordered the wine. But so we had a cocktail each, a bottle of wine. We had bread and butter and pickles.
Mm-hmm.
So bread and butter and pickles.
You're at 100 on booze right now, right?
Bread and butter and pickles.
Mm-hmm.
We had a vegetable, like a roasted vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
I had a piece of fish and Naomi had a pasta. What do you think the bill was before tip?
$250.
Yeah.
$400.
Stop. What?
What?
$400.
Wait, what?
So sorry, it was $350 before tip.
Oh my God. Oh. I shouldn't laugh.
It's New York.
Holy shit.
I mean, the pasta, which was a vegetarian pasta, was like $40.
Oh my God.
This is a wine bar.
That's shocking.
Yeah. I mean, and look, I had heard this about this place, that it was really expensive.
Whoa.
Like, I was pretty blown away by how expensive it was. And I was like, again, like, that. I guess that's also how you know the neighborhood's going through a transition. Like, Fort Greene used to be all neighborhood places. Now there's definitely, like, look, there's other.
It's very hot.
But
right
again,
now,
like,
too.
I think Theodora is total value for money. And I didn't feel that way about Theodora when I went there. I've not been to Sailor, but I've heard people think that Sailor is totally worth it. So, like, and now people are going to be like, well, he's not talking about those two places. but it was just very expensive. I was really surprised at how pricey it was. The food was great.
Yeah.
Like, the food was great, and I loved the wine. The cocktail left something to be desired, but I think it could be what you're saying. I don't think I like clarified cocktails. I don't think they can be done well. They're never balanced.
There's sweet or something.
And whatever they do to clarify it, especially when they're trying to be cute and not use regular milk, so they were using a coconut milk or something, it just does – it imparts that flavor, right? And it's just never going to – and we just said it was this really weird, like, Robitussin flavor.
Ooh.
That we were just like, it tastes like medicine. We can't explain – what medicine it specifically is, but it had like a very medicinal quality to it. And then you bring in that it creates that silkiness that has that sort of cough syrupy thing. And you're like, yeah. Oh, I'm basically drinking cough syrup.
Surely, yeah.
Yeah. But my complaint to start was just the wine list. Like the unaffordability of it and the fact that, like, I know who Forlorn Hope is. I think they make great wines, but I don't think a lot of people do. And that's the value bottle. And there were a few other American producers, and then everything else was very expensive, was hard, and then just the type.
Was it French, too?
Very French. Yeah. Very French. A little bit of Italy, not much.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of Spain, not much. Mostly French. And I think where they're looking for the value in the French section, but again, was still more expensive than stuff from California. A few cool American producers. And the American producers was like 3 or 4 bottles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about natty stuff?
Was Languedoc. Well, it's all natural. I think the people who started this place like sort of come from the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
But like, yeah, their affordable French stuff was Languedoc.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know any of those producers. And then it was affordable stuff from America, which was really interesting to me because also part of the narrative is that like American producers are expensive. But what I also thought was really weird is like they're doing American producers, but it was all California and Oregon, like no New York, no Washington, no Virginia,
yeah.
Like who also are all in the city making cool stuff. Like, I was like, oh shit, maybe I'll get like a Finger Lakes Riesling or something, or Finger Lakes Pinot Noir. Like, none of that was there.
But I'm guessing it wasn't like Napa Cabs either.
No Napa Cabs. Right. No, like, it was Forlorn Hope, Jolie Led, Martha Stewman. It's like the greatest hits.
Yeah, sure.
Like the people that everyone kind of sort of knows.
Those, yeah.
All the like sort of like Pax Mafia.
Yeah.
Is that what we're calling them now?
Pax Mafia. Yeah, I like Pax. I think he makes great wine. Yeah, but yeah, yeah. It was Pax Mafia. Uh-huh. So like that was, it was kind of like that world of people. Yeah. Those were those producers, and that was it from America. It was like probably three or four in each section of like red, white. At least they didn't have an interesting red section.
Can I ask one question about this, Adam?
Yeah.
Were most people there drinking wine?
Interestingly, I saw ton of cocktails going out because they had sat us like very close to the bar. I saw a lot of cocktails going out.
What was the by the glass menu like?
Pretty short, like a few glasses in each, and different actually than what was on the bottle list, which is normal, I guess. But it was. I saw some wine, but like now that I think about it, Zach, the table next to us didn't have wine. The table in the booth, they had one bottle, but they also all had cocktails.
And this is a wine bar.
Yes. And then I saw a ton of cocktails going out, which was really, really interesting. And again, yeah, it's supposed to be like a wine, that wine bar or wine focused restaurant.
Yeah. Well, since apparently no one can focus on the list, how could they order it?
You know, by the way, I wanted to mention something, which is that I rarely re-listen to the podcast afterwards, but I was listening to, I think, our Monday podcast from last week. Yeah. I think. And Zach, I missed a really good dad joke you told, and I got to like be better at picking up on your dad jokes. But there was like, I forget what he said, but I was like, oh shit, neither you or I reacted to it. I was like, Zach literally told a dad joke there, and we just said like, okay, let's move on. Let's keep talking. So you know what? I had to acknowledge that one.
Well, sometimes I slip them in under the cover of lag or something.
Yeah, yeah. So. I was like, okay. Anyways, Joanna, you're going to set up another episode that you're going to set us up
yes,
for?
Yes, I'll set us up. This is a topic that Hannah mentioned in our editorial meeting this week. That
All right, Hannah.
Something that we've discussed definitely in the past in the context of sustainability, but this idea that there's this perceived double standard in wine and spirits around sustainability, and that you know, wine is basically faced with needing to be sustainable as an industry. There are all of these issues. The bottles are heavy. You know, its carbon footprint is terrible, and seemingly spirits don't encounter this pressure as much. And so I thought this was an interesting topic for us to talk about because, yeah, I think we all have thoughts around like what matters to consumers around sustainability and why this applies, why it feels more prevalent in wine than it does in spirits. And ultimately, is this a factor in why wine is losing with consumers and spirits is winning?
I think that two things maybe jump out to me when I think about this. One of them is a sort of inherent, like wine likes to talk about itself and does talk about itself as, in a lot of cases, as a sort of, you know, agricultural product.
Yeah.
You know, the vineyard is a huge part of the story of wine and always has been, long before sustainability or any of that was really a conversation in any industry. But, you know, the idea of connection to the vineyard, obviously many wineries themselves are situated on vineyards, not all, but many are. And the romance of wine in part is this connection to the land. So in a way, it makes a kind of sense that for wine as a category, the consumer and the industry as a whole might think more about sustainability in a whole host of ways, whether that's organics, biodynamics, viticultural practices, whether it's packaging and all of that stuff, or whether it's, you know, anything else that fits into that very broad umbrella. And with some exceptions, there are those exceptions. Spirits are process oriented. Often the raw inputs are commodities. They're not necessarily the focus of the story in the same way that the vineyard and the grapes are the center of the story around wine. So I think there is a sort of understandable reason why the two categories are maybe internally talk about themselves differently and why consumer expectation is different. But it's well worth noting that there's no reason why, like, a bottle filled with vodka has the same carbon footprint as a bottle filled with wine, and shipping it is, you know, weighs the same amount. It's still the same cost. There's no reason why we couldn't be talking about more sustainable packaging for spirits in the way that we are talking about it for wine in a lot of cases. It just, I don't know, it hasn't, consumers have not en masse said, or even in small numbers really said, this is important to us. So the industry generally is not moving in that direction.
I think there's a few other things happening here too. I think for whatever reason, you know, and there are a lot. Okay, so first, there are a lot of fine wineries mm-hmm. that who are big or are bigger than most people would assume. Right. I even think like the like if you were told the production level of most champagne houses that is that are considered high end, you'd be blown away, or the production level of some of like the classified Bordeaux growths. Right. Because of how you can just buy a vineyard and all of a sudden that also becomes classified as your growth, which is crazy. But so I think that there is some of that. But the wine, the perception of wine versus the perception of alcohol, of spirits has always just been this weird conflict where, like, in wine, we for whatever reason believe that smaller is better. That the only way that you can pay such attention to detail when it comes to the vinification and the fruit and the harvesting, et cetera, because it is this truly agricultural product mm-hmm. that really matters at the exact time that you pick it and really matters at how you crush it and how long you let it ferment and what, and if you let it go through another fermentation and whether you barrel or don't and the kind of wood, et cetera, is that we just believe the only way you can have that much attention to detail is being small. Sure. That if you get bigger, it just,
it's impossible.
It's impossible.
Sure.
Whereas in a majority of spirits, and I've heard well-known bartenders say this, like the bigger you are, the more you can actually mechanize your distillation
yeah.
to actually get better, to be more precise. That the idea of precision in wine is being small and the idea of precision in spirits is being large. Right? If you can have all of these computers, et cetera, you can take your cuts more precisely. Mm-hmm. You can make sure that the fermentation happens at the exact right temperature, the distillation happens at the exact right temperature, that then you are large enough in bourbon to age so many different barrels that you have a variety of options when it comes to blending. Right? And so like being big is actually a good thing.
For consistency.
For consistency and for quality.
Okay.
And it is not considered to be the same in
for wine.
Right. And basically like what bartenders will say is when you think about most spirits besides scotch, mm-hmm. and I would even say until recently, scotch was the only thing that people would think of this way. You know, bourbon has now sort of started to take on that world of scotch where people really think about it as a sippable thing. I think scotch, there was some, you know, love of the craft and maybe the smaller single malt. But that, again, single malt really has only been a thing since the 70s. Spirits is an ingredient in a cocktail that a bartender is making for you or that you are making for yourself. So it needs to be consistent because it is an ingredient.
Right.
And so that's why you have the freakouts of the bartending community when like
they lower the ABV.
They lower the, yeah exactly, right? Yeah. Because it was an ingredient they've come to rely on for that specific ABV in something they actually create or in the martini you make at home or in the gin and tonic you make or whatever. And wine is not an ingredient.
Right.
It is its own thing. And so you want to think that whoever made that thing for you took as much care and craft and artistry into it as possible before you popped it and literally just poured it in a glass and consumed it.
Right.
And that's why I think it's different. And that's why I think people care so much more and why bigger in wine is always going to have an issue compared to spirits.
Well, because scale in wine means for a lot of people mass produced
commoditization.
Is, right.
And that what people like about wine is that there is variation year to year. People do not want variation in spirits.
Right.
If I should be able to, unless like if you talk to Aaron with Dusty Booze, yeah, okay, fine. Like if someone forgets about an old bottle of gin or bourbon, et cetera, in you know, Meemaw's closet. And then I wanted to say Meemaw real bad. and then they just pull it out 30 years later and you drink it. It doesn't taste like what Grandpappy drank, right. You know. But for the most part, like the Beef Eater, which is why people were so upset when they lowered the ABV, each bottle should taste the same year to year to year to year to year to year to year. Right. It's a consistent product. People like the vintage variation. Going back to my whole thing of why I liked Hannah's piece from last Friday, you know, when I talked about it on Friday or Thursday, shit, I even forgot that we still publish on Thursday, about, you know, understanding whether or not you should be paying more or less for older vintages on a wine list. Like, I think that consumers really like that variation happens in wine. Again, because it is considered to be an artisanal product.
And so then the expectations for wine as an artisanal product to be sustainable.
Small and higher. Yes.
Yeah, than for spirits.
Yes, 100%. Because I think most people, like, whatever happened to, I was thinking about this a few, when we started Vine Pair 10 years ago this year, there was a really prominent organic spirit on the market that I don't think you hear about at all anymore. Do you guys remember what it was? It was like an organic vodka and an organic gin. And that their whole branding was they were an organic vodka. I'm looking it up right now.
None of us remember, so clearly it didn't matter.
Now there's things like Hansen, there's a thing called Crop. But it was like a really well-known organic vodka. Y'all remind me if you guys remember what it was called. And it was like pretty well known. And then it just kind of disappeared. I think Prairie.
Okay.
You guys remember Prairie? I don't know anyone that talks about Prairie anymore. Because I don't think most consumers give a shit. It's distilled. Like, I just don't think that the organic selling or the sustainable selling matters as much to consumers when it comes to spirits. And it 100% matters with wine because, again, wine is truly agricultural.
Yeah.
You know, we just had a producer in the office this past week, you know, a rosé producer that we love. And what does every fucking winemaker say to us? Every winemaker says the same fucking quote. You know what it is, Zach, right?
It's 90% in the vineyard, 10% in the winery.
Basically, yeah. Oh, his was 80. It's 80%.
Yeah, but it's a variation, right? Great wine is made in the vineyard. 80% of the wine is in the vineyard. 90% of the wine is in the vineyard. It's all about the vineyard. It's the vineyard. It's the vineyard. It's the vineyard. It's an agricultural product. I never fucking hear bourbon producers say, oh, man, yeah, 80% of that bourbon is the corn has grown and how it's in the production of that corn and how that wheat's grown, that cool southern air. No, warm southern air. No one says that.
Okay, but we are seeing this with tequila, though, right? I feel
a
like
a little bit, but
now.
Most consumers still don't care, which is why, you know, the tequila matchmaker stuff has not been that big of a deal to the majority of consumers because most consumers don't care. The tequila has additives in it. They don't care. Like the number one, you know, the fastest growing number one selling tequila is Casamigos.
Yep.
Like they don't care. They like it. Like they like, what is the stat? Like over 70 to almost 80% of all tequila has additives in it. They don't care.
Right.
There's a small, small group of people in the world of tequila that really care. I think a lot of wine consumers who are winos, including those on this podcast, do ultimately care about wine. I do.
Wine being organic or sustainable.
And sustainable, and I care about the production methods, and I ask way more questions about it than I ever do about spirits. I just do.
So do you think that it's really consumers driving this in wine, driving these standards in wine?
I think it's the gatekeepers, and because here's the other thing is I don't doubt that you become passionate about spirits and you care deeply and you can become really geeky, but it's very different in wine. It becomes like all consuming in a weird way. You start learning history and geography and science and, you know, you just listen to Wine 101. Like, you know, I listen to every single Wine 101 episode because you're like taking this incredible like history lesson every week with Keith. And it just causes you to care about all these other things, I think, in a very different way because of how long the vineyard has been here and what that means for the land and the place. And this other thing is like, you know, Keith talking about he's on Burgundy right now, right? And like, you're thinking, holy shit, like people have been farming grapes right here for hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years. And they are farming them in vineyards that we still today think are the best vineyards in this place. There is not a single place in the U.S. where they've been farming corn for bourbon for hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And people have decided this is the best place to grow corn for the best bourbon. Or wheat to finish it. Like, does anyone know where Pappy gets any of its grains? I don't.
No.
And I think that you make a really important point here to bring this back to the question of why wine is held to a different standard and also holds itself to a different standard. Because again, for many of the producers we're talking about, maybe not some of the largest producers, but even the medium to fairly large producers, you know, vines are a perennial crop. They're something you plant and take years to even achieve production. You then hope that they are productive for decades, if not more than that. And every year, generally, your wine comes from the same place. So it makes sense that, in a way, you as a winery, you as a grape grower, have to be deeply invested in the sustainability of that vineyard in a whole host of ways. And very few, not none, but very few spirits producers are working on that model. You know, most of them don't grow the grain or other material that goes into their, that's the sort of base of their fermentation. Usually it's something that shows up on a truck, frankly. And in most cases, what matters is the production facility. What matters is maybe some of the special inputs, where you're getting your juniper and whatnot from if you're making gin, where you're getting your barrels from if you're making whiskey, et cetera, right? But in the end, you're not as connected to agriculture. You're not as connected to a specific plot of land that you, in a way, have to take care of. And again, it's no surprise that the rise of things like organics and biodynamics in wine came about after an era of a lot of synthetic fertilizers and other, you know, pesticides, things like that, that had short-term benefits and long-term costs. And so, you know, wine, you know, growers of all kinds, I think, even if you are not someone who practices organics or biodynamics or who even cares about sustainability from a broader sort of global good standpoint, but just has to think about vineyard health because it's the source of the thing you make and the thing you want to continue to make and sell, et cetera. And yeah, I just don't think distilleries in particular have to think that way. They have to think different ways. They have different, you know, different concerns and different models. And I don't know if it's a matter of gatekeeping. I don't know if it's a matter of, you know, consumers driving this. I think it's just a matter of the two are not the same. And so, yeah, it's going to express itself in ways that are maybe helpful to one category in some senses and maybe damaging in another.
Yeah. I think winemakers have to be adaptable, like you're saying, in a different way for the longevity and success of their business.
Yeah. And look, I do want to have a conversation we talked about in the future as well. And like, if people have thoughts, I would love to hear them before we have this conversation about, you know, Jamie Good wrote a really good piece, whether or not like good wine can be made by big wineries or like fine wine, like can you scale fine wine basically?
Yeah.
And I think that's a fun conversation to have in the future. If you have thoughts, hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. We can take in everyone's opinions before we have that conversation. But I think just the general perception, right, is the same. I think it's the same. If you think about it, wine to me, out of the three things we talk about, is the most similar to the other really collectible fine arts of the world. And mostly when I talk about the truly collectible, I'm talking about real painting, art.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about art as a collectible, most consumers are pretty surprised when they find out that as artists get bigger and bigger and bigger,
They have other people
that actually make their art.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not the people that are 100% making all of the work. That the work is being made by them in terms of maybe their oversight, the idea, etc. But then they have a team. And I've heard of people before who've also been appalled about that. I think in the collecting community, that's become more accepted now. They understand that like that's how these pieces get made. That's how someone really realizes their vision, right? Sometimes, especially when the work is very large. But it's the same kind of thing, right? You expect if this artist signed it, every brushstroke was their own because you think, well, and we don't know. Were all of Van Gogh's brushstrokes his? We're not. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that really applies to wine then too. Like you really in people are very surprised when they hear that anything in wine was not influenced or done by the winemaker and that they weren't involved in everything. And so that's why I feel like there's always these sort of like negative pieces that come out about technology in wine, AI in wine. And because there's that subset of consumer that really views this as a very artisanal, Etsy-esque, if you want to, you know, be frank about it, product. Mm-hmm. And is why then it has all the standards it has, which is why wine gets asked, you know, producers get asked so many questions. It's why the natural movement, wine movement started, because yeah. I think the dogma that exists in wine that even we believe in then was found its extreme in natural wine to negative, you know, and taken to negative places. But those that was still an extreme that was coming out of the same world that I think anyone that gets into wine kind of falls into, which is like, I care about the craft of how this is made. And I really care about, there's not a single winery visit that you go on, especially in Europe. In the U.S., not as much, especially in Napa, just because of where all the vineyards are located, but like where they don't say, would you like to walk the vineyard? I would like to walk you through the vineyard.
Of course. Of course.
I've never been on a
spirit. I mean, we've had like VR where
yeah,
in the vineyard.
I've never, ever. And usually the winery visit actually is the shortest part. Like you spend like an hour in the vineyard. Look at the rocks. Here's some soil. The winemaker picks some shit up. The dog runs through. That's the best part. Yeah. You know, you try some grapes. If you're there during the right time of the year, then you go to you walk the winery very briefly. Mm-hmm. Here's the winery. Everyone's, you know, every winemaker that makes the same jokes. Here's some tanks. You've all seen tanks. Here's the barrels. You've all seen barrels. Maybe some people like want to know about who the cooperage is, and you're like, that's a brown noser. Shut up.
Drink
and then,
the wine already.
Yeah, and then you go and you drink. Mm-hmm. I've never on a single spirits visit, whether it's for a press visit or on my own, etc., been asked if I would like to see the grains, if I would like to. The only place is tequila.
Sure.
Is Jalisco.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken us to the agave fields.
Yeah.
You and I were there together.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time I've ever, in any spirit visit ever, been taken to see the product that is fermented in some way to turn into alcohol.
Right.
It's probably the closest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. So last part here then. Do you think that this factors into why wine is losing out?
I think that all of this helps reinforce that it's a very snobby beverage, that it's a very elitist thing, because I just sounded like a fucking elitist probably to some people. You know, it just when you really start talking about wine, it's hard. It's really hard to not sound like an elitist. And there's ways to make it fun. But, you know, the second that like you're the person who has a friend who's just getting into wine and they bring over a wine that you're like, oh, that's a mass-produced bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And you say something like, oh, I know you like this, but you would like this more. You know how many times that someone's like, oh, I'm turned off. I'm just going to bring tequila. They're all going to like it. No, you know, like the thing is, I think that I have a love for all wine. And I do think that there are wines that are very large wines that still really much really deliver. And I think are really wonderful for the world of wine and allow so many people to be able to drink wine. And if you go to Europe, the majority of wines that the majority of people are drinking in the countries that drink wine are $4 bottles of wine, and their mass production are co-ops. But it's still large producers making these wines.
Yeah,
they're just not brands because they're not marketing them in the same ways. But it's the same thing. But I think on the high-end wine, where wine is trying to compete on that cocktail pricing level, yeah, I think that is a little bit maybe why. But there's other issues, too. I just think this is
part of it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah.
See, to me, this is more a symptom than a cause in my eyes. I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Like, the way in which wine feels maybe rightly compelled to talk about these topics and this whole world of sustainability is because wine is an agricultural product in a way that spirits are not, because it's a product of producers of widely varying sizes. I mean, again, think about, you know, I want to, you know, to come back to where we started today's episode, you know, with you talking about your experience at a wine bar, like, without seeing that list, I don't know, but you can't possibly think of a cocktail bar anywhere in the world whose spirits list is going to have, you know, production spirits from producers as small as a wine bar can have, right? Like, you can have a few bottles from producers who might only make 1,000 cases of wine or less. And that's just not something you're going to do with spirits, with maybe very rare exceptions if they happen to be, you know, in your specific market. And so, you know, the spirits industry is much more consolidated into a few big, you know, companies. It just, there are fewer firms and people that matter in the industry. And wine is, yes, there are big wine companies, there are big wine producers, but there are also tens of thousands, if not more, small and medium-sized producers, and getting them all to cooperate on anything is impossible. Getting even very many of them to cooperate on anything is pretty difficult. And that's a blessing and a curse. And I think to me, this whole conversation is more of a, like I said, like it's a symptom of wine's structure and the way it works and the realities of the beverage and how it works in a kind of modern landscape. But I don't think it's causative for why wine is struggling.
Really interesting. Let us know what you think. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. We'd love to hear the opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Sure, I was like, sure.
And I do. I love the emails.
I do too. Even the ones that
even
have
the late night spicy emails that we get.
The spicy ones. The real spicy ones. And I'll talk to you both on Thursday.
Have a nice week.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.